my God. I hate this sound. Sorry, Rusty. I don't know at which point I'm supposed to get overwhelmed, but it's right here. My name is Mickey. I'm an alcoholic. So, it's what a long, strange journey it's been to get here to talk to you tonight. The reason I'm hesitating is because I've been in this for, actually on February 12th, 45 years. I thought when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, if I could get 2 weeks of sobriety, that's all I came for, I promise you. If I could get 2 weeks sober, and I wouldn't hurt that bad, and I wouldn't be so sick, and my hands wouldn't be curled up when I woke up in the morning, I would be grateful to you, and I would go back out and get on the train that carried me here since I was 5 years old. I drank from the time I was five until I was 27. And came to you and washed up in 1311 York Street. But that 2 weeks, the reason I said I wanted 2 weeks wasn't because I was thirsty. I didn't want to drink anymore, truly. You know, how'd you like a good glass of sulfuric acid? No, thank you. No, thank you. But I didn't think it was possible to be alive and not drink. I'd never been able to do it. And it's not like, you know, I was hanging out in the gin mills at 5 years old. I grew up in Europe, and in Europe they give children, you know, wine cut back with water for the evening meal. And so they wet down an alcoholic. I didn't know it. They didn't know it, and here we went. And they're very liberal in Europe about children drinking. And, you know, and I got nailed to the cross. I got nailed to the cross then. I guess I'll just start at the moment of getting sober. I'm not the moment of getting sober, but the moment of going to 1311 York Street and starting this journey. Now, what we were like, what I was like, was I was a shell. I was a chameleon. I would be anything I thought you wanted me to be just so you would accept me. And I think it actually is in the big book. They talk about you don't want to have the two or three groups that you've been hanging with ever meet each other because you've got a whole different persona in each one. That was me. And I came in here and they took me through York Street and they said, you know, this is DPR, and I would see all the old men sitting on their chairs. The meetings were upstairs. This was a fabulous Victorian mansion in Denver that had been somehow purchased by or donated to or whatever it was for an AA club, and it was like the downtown club, and it was where those of us who were in severe need washed up. So DPR was dead blank row. I'll let you figure it out. Maybe someone can tell you. And don't go here, Mickey. If you don't work a program, you're going to end up on DPR. Okay, and I had a red badge, and the red badge had my name on it, and the red badge meant, please tell this guy where the bathroom is. I was starting out in a new life. And I started to go to meetings, and I went to York Street for about 3 years. I hung on to it like, you know, I would come there after work. I ate a lot of navy bean soup, and you know, and then I would be there when the cabbies came in, because I was afraid to leave. And if you'd have told me to stack BBs over in the corner, standing on my head, and that's what it took to be sober, I would have done it, because I wanted nothing. I wanted out. I wanted out. It was not pleasant. It was like somebody reached into a tank and grabbed a great big fish and threw it on the sidewalk, and that's how I felt. I had no connection with not being lit up one way or another, and I didn't take drugs. I smoked grass 5 times in as many years, and it was like, you know, you take a hit and pretty soon I'm hearing rain on the roof and it isn't raining. And I'm paranoid, and I started that way, and it was not good. But I was sober now. I was sober now. And, you know, my wife is sitting right in front of me. I'm one of the luckiest men in the world. And we've been together for 48 years. And that's a good deal. But God had to put that together because I was just fractured. I was fractured and I was a chameleon and I was just fighting for my life. Before I got to York Street, I can remember going out of my mind one night, just screaming and crying and banging on the door of a rectory of a Catholic parish near me and just begging the priest to help me. Just help me. I'm disintegrating. And so what happens is I ran into a group of guys that were not at York Street. And so they were very, very tough, and they had this thing, and I referred to them earlier, maybe yesterday, and I picked my sponsor out of these guys, and I picked him because I thought he wasn't so tough. And as I shared, he had just come back from 3 tours in Vietnam as a Navy medic attached to the Marines, and he was tough as anything in the world. And he was gay. And I had never been around a gay person. And the reason I tell you that is because I had a lot of ignorance about what gay meant, okay? And George was gay. And so why that was important was because I was afraid I was gay, okay? And I'll tell you why I thought I was gay is because I don't want to hit anybody. I get violent in words only and only when, you know, I get out of my head emotionally, whatever, but not so much anymore. But I thought that I was emotional, I was very sensitive, I was all those things, and I thought gay meant sissy. And if you know anything about gay, you know that it absolutely does not mean sissy. Okay, so I'm there, and now, why that's important, what I was like, and this is the progression out of what I thought I was, and the trouble, I was carrying this weight. You know, I'm married 3 years, but I was afraid I was gay because I told you I had those characteristics. So I tell George, you know, I think I'm gay. And George goes, okay. And so we just talked. And George had lost 100 pounds in Weight Watchers. And he had a big picture of him up in his utilities in uniform where he weighed like 100 pounds more. And so George would give me Weight Watchers ice cream and cookies when I would visit him. And he said, it's okay, Mickey, there's vitamins in them. I was 6'3" and I weighed 145 pounds. So I look like an antenna, and I'm eating, you know, Weight Watchers cookies and ice cream, and it's okay. It's got vitamins in it. Thank you, George. So as we get to talking and everything, I'm trying to communicate with George about this burden I'm carrying of being gay. And George looks at me, and he said, Mickey, you're not gay. Like, what does he know? And nothing George could say to me would move me from being gay. I did not want to be gay. But I got this thing sized up. Now I'm introducing you to the concrete bunker I carry on my shoulders. That's why it's so difficult for me to learn, especially then. You can't penetrate that concrete, and I'm carrying, don't you understand? I'm suffering because I'm gay. Mickey, you're not gay. So we went through that. Now, it made a big deal of difference because I come from an all-military family. My father went to West Point. My oldest brother was in the Marine Corps in Vietnam. My other brother was a Navy pilot, a naval aviator in Vietnam. And I got kicked out of every school I went to until I got to high school. I'm like Wrong Way Hannigan in this all military family, and I'm gay. So I'm having problems. And George had like really, as I mentioned yesterday, he had had all the war he wanted, and he was studying to be a Methodist minister. And so I would go over and visit George and so on down the line. Now, after a while, and George was very patient with me. He was very, very loving. And what George was doing back in the States now, too, he was also teaching English to the Vietnamese immigrants that were coming over, and he's helping them to get settled. And you know, I just loved George. And George used to tell me, he said, "Mickey, it's always darkest before the dawn." I was really having a lot of trouble. And I would call George up on the phone, and I would say, "George, is it almost dawn yet?" And so after a while, to put a cap on this phase of the deal, George one day looks at me and he said, "Mickey, I'm going to put in your imagination a picture of a naked woman in front of you and a naked man. Which one do you choose?" And I'm going, "I choose the woman." He said, "Mickey, you're not gay." Okay, so there's one burden lifted. I could go home without sweating. We got it all good now. It's all good. You're not gay. Okay, thank you, George and God. It's okay. If you're gay, you're gay. I just don't happen to be gay. Then the second one was I had survivor's guilt from the Vietnam War, and I'd never had a shot fired at me because I come from an all-military family. And they went and I didn't. It took me 27 years to get over Vietnam. Anybody who tells me that stopping drinking is enough to cruise on through life, well, I just don't agree, okay? And our wounds are deep. We're not kidding. These wounds are deep. And somebody can address them and say, "Hey, it's okay, buddy, you know, blah, blah." And I had bad knees, and it was congenital. And I'd had two operations at Fitzsimmons Army Hospital because I was, military dependent. And I'd been with those guys. I was in a 40-bed orthopedic ward at Fitzsimmons Hospital in Denver, and there were 39 combat casualties in me. And I had a hip-to-toe cast because they had really done a lot of architecture and carpentry in my left knee. And I'm laying in bed, and this is an aside, but I'm laying in bed, and I start hurting. And pretty soon, I start screaming. And I'm cussing, and I'm out of my mind. And they sent the chaplain in, and he said, "You know, kid, these guys have fought a war, and, you know, you don't deserve to even blah, blah, blah." And they put me in a solitary room, and my foot was turning purple. And what happened is they put the cast on too tight, from the hip to my toes. And I was in agony. And finally somebody came in and they split the, you know, with those funny vibrator things, they cut the cast down both sides. They'd been hitting me with Demerol, Vistaril. And I remember this nurse, bless nurses, I mean it. She put her face down real close to mine and she said, "Kid, we've given you enough, whatever it is, painkillers to knock a horse out. Why aren't you gone?" And they split that thing, and I turned to my brother, Gus, and I said, "Would you light me a cigarette?" And that was the last thing I remember. And that's the only time I really thought, God, drugs are good. I mean, seriously, drugs are good. And I'm very, very drug intolerant, and I'd seen the movie Dr. Zhivago before I went into that ward. And in the middle of it, they're giving me something to sleep, and I'm in the middle of the night, and I'm punching the button for the corpsman. And I say, "We got to bury this guy." Now, all of that he's hearing is from the Vietnam side of things. It was in the movie. I had to bury that guy in the snow because the ground was frozen. I am the biggest admirer of vets you ever will meet in your life. And thank you for your service if you're in this room tonight. So how do I get over survivor's guilt when I couldn't fight? And there came George. And for 2 years, he walked me out of that valley. And he gave me some hope that, you know, I wasn't called to that. It's okay. And I started working on that. Those two burdens were putting my lights out. And then I started to try to work on this. Whoopsie. We were having trouble with personal relationships. I'd been kicked out of it's just like, and when I got kicked out of school, it wasn't, we need to have a parent-teacher meeting. It was like, get the hints. Don't come back. You know, and I don't see myself that way. I don't see myself being such a problem in a classroom that we can't talk about it. I had a little nun pick my desk up right in the middle of the classroom, turn it upside down, and throw me on the floor. I got beaten with her rosary. I had a principal in another Catholic school lock me up in her office, and she came in every half hour and beat me. And I came out of that thing with a face and a head like a tomato. And you know what I said inside of myself? There's something wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with my church. There is something wrong with you. And they couldn't beat my religion out of me. And, right? This is my faith, and you ain't going to beat it out of me. And they kicked me out of the schools, and I probably deserved it. Not that treatment, you understand, but I was angry. What was going on in my house, incidentally, was my parents would argue, and they argued a lot. My parents were not alcoholic, but they drank buku. And I got so scared that my big brother would come in. I would try to go to sleep, and he would come in and he would hold me while I shook, while they were screaming. And I got into AA, and I couldn't understand why I couldn't fall asleep. And then I remembered that. So I had to make a decision that I was going to go to sleep now. It was too scary because you'd wake up in World War III. We couldn't control our emotional natures. Like our speaker last night, I'm indicating a shrug with my, never mind. We were a prey to misery and depression. I am still a prey to misery and depression. You know what I mean? It's like I'm riding high in April and 15 minutes later I'm shot down in May. And I don't know where it comes from. All of a sudden I'm seized by fear. Or. Notice while I'm reading these, please do a little gut check while we're in the room together if you care to. Join with me. And you notice it says, and it doesn't say in here, some of us had this. Some of us had this. Or when we were drinking, or when we were hungover. This, to me, is a partial laundry list of the disease, of symptoms of the disease of alcoholism. What I'm reading is alcoholism. Do other people have this? Yeah, but I wonder what they do with the full list. We couldn't make a living. Well, that certainly worked. When I was in school, if a teacher said something and I didn't like it, I'd stand up in this classroom and tell a teacher what I thought of them. Maybe that's why I got kicked out. We couldn't make a living. I had that same response at a job. And you lean on me and, you know, I'll show you, I'll ruin my life. We had a feeling of uselessness. The only reason I stayed, that I even gave a darn about my drinking or stayed sober was for Marie. I wanted out, but I couldn't hurt Marie. I didn't want to hurt Marie. We were full of fear. Now, I think that we could throw all of the rest of these out for a moment, and we'll just ask an earth person, how do you react to that statement, right? For us. Every time I read that with somebody I'm working with or whatever, they go, oh, yeah, I'm sure you got it. I wonder what an earth person would do that. Full of fear, what the heck are you talking about? Right? But, I get up afraid. I got to go to work. And then I got to check in with God and get the power and, you know, and to be able to advance into the day. We were unhappy. That doesn't sound like much, does it? We were unhappy. What's unhappy look like? I used to ask people when I first got in AA, did you have hangovers? And I'd look in their eyes, and it's for some of them, I knew they did not know what I was talking about. Are you unhappy? We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Well, when you're as self-centered as I am, who cares about other people? I mean, really. You help me. I wish that, I know it's funny, but I wish it wasn't true. When I was growing up, really, I felt like I was under a spotlight. The spotlight was on me, and it cast a very narrow illumination around my feet. And if you stood real close to me, I would notice you. And if you didn't, I could care less, unless you were pretty. When I was in the eighth grade, I moved up to Rapid City, South Dakota with my father. We were living in Denver, and he got a job in Rapid City. And so we moved up there, and I went to a Catholic grade school up there in the eighth grade. And I was a new kid in town, and you know how awkward that could be, you know, you want to be liked and da-da-da-da. And I was elected class president. Right? Mr. Moonlight. And so it came time for show and tell. There was going to be a big show and tell deal. Thank you. And so I had grown up in Europe. I walked all the battlefields of Europe, man. I mean, I was clued in. And the flea market in Paris, if you've ever seen pictures of Fifth Avenue in New York, and I have the big racks of clothes, and they're running around in the garment district delivering these things. Well, imagine those same racks full of German uniforms. Imagine a table full of every kind of sword and dagger and anything you've seen with the swastika on it, and all of that. And I collected that because there they were, and I was fascinated with that. So comes show and tell at Cathedral Grade School. And I want to bring my Nazi memorabilia. They want to know who I was, I'm telling you. My Nazi memorabilia to the show and tell. I don't know what the other kids were bringing. And I never had a chance to find out either. And they said, ixnay on the swastika A. So in those days, nurses wore these white shoes and white uniforms and caps and all that. And they would have shoe polish, you know, in liquid shoe polish in a bottle with a cotton dauber on the end that they could keep their shoes looking nice. So I got one of those, and I put swastikas this big in every window of the Cathedral Grade School on a Saturday night. Tell me no. Maybe this is why I got kicked out of the schools. This is your class president. This is like I'm talking, well, it's really not like I'm talking about a stranger. I was there. Anyway, and come Monday morning, and the swastikas are still there on the windows as everybody troops into school. And so Dan, my friend Dan, lived right behind the school, and he was my cohort and my co-conspirator in this thing, in pulling off this assignment. And the principal came and called Dan out into the hallway. Dan didn't come back. Then the next person she calls is me. And I got out of the hallway and I said, I didn't do it. She says, you didn't do what? I said, I didn't put the Dan got called out into the hallway because he was going home for lunch. And I got called out there because I was going without permission to Dan's house to have lunch. And in the eighth grade in 1960, when you graduated from the eighth grade, you had your first dance you know, and you got dressed up, and the girls got dressed up in their pretty dresses, and you could go to your first dance. Well, needless to say, they didn't include me. I was standing across the street in a vinyl motorcycle jacket, drinking Grain Belt beer and smoking old gold cigarettes, and the hell with you. And when I got kicked out the day that they discovered that, I went home and I couldn't find any booze, and I drank a bottle of creme de menthe. Well, it's better than Listerine. Not much better. Who let this guy in, right? So if we're going to tell the truth across the board here, and I have been telling the truth, I had a deep love for God. I was an altar boy and a vandal. Right? And I can remember going into the cathedral like Bill Wilson did when he was over in England, in Winchester Cathedral, I think it was. And he stood before the altar and he knew that there was a God. And one warm day, after I'd gotten kicked out and I knew I was not going to graduate with the class, I walked into that cathedral right next to the school, and I stood in front of the altar and I knew there was a God. I knew that I was a God. I could feel him. And I stood there and I was washed in that feeling, but I knew the train was waiting outside the door and I had to get on the train, and I did. Now that's a little boy and a young adolescent boy who is wounded. If I could find him today, I'd put my arms around him, I'd wash his tongue out with soap, and I'd do everything I could for him, and I know he wouldn't listen. Right? He would not listen. So to come into Alcoholics Anonymous, there was this progression, and it went like that. I guess I'm going to just tell the whole bloody thing. And when I was 8 years old, I was sexually molested by one of my oldest brother. He was 7 years older than me, and one of his friends sexually molested me. And I told you, I was a chameleon. I would have done anything if you would accept me. And apparently I did that. Now, I was sexualized. I was 8 years old, and now I am sexualized. And that went on in my life, and it was like I had no idea that when you're hurt like that, that's what happens to you. So I thought I was scum. I got into pornography. It was just, I grew up like that. That's certainly not who I am. That is certainly not who I am. But God, without Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have died like that. I would have died like that. So I didn't drink today, and I'm a winner. It's just a little hollow and shy of the mark for me. You know, I mean, there's nothing, please, if I drink, I'm not diminishing alcohol. I am deadly affected by alcohol. I'll give you an example. I didn't know there was something that they called non-alcoholic beer. And so I was like, 15, 17 years sober, and I applied for a job at this company, and we had lunch, and I looked at the menu, and they said they had Moosey, non-alcoholic beer. I'm saying, God, I haven't had a beer in 17 years or whatever it was. And so I ordered a beer, and I poured it in my glass, and I started drinking my beer. I felt a little lightheaded, and I felt just like a little spacey or something, you know, and I thought, well, Marie, if I give Marie alcohol, her face gets bright red. So she's my, you know, seeing eye person. So I called her and I said, I'm doing this and I'm bringing home. Well, first my reaction was, this stuff is great. I'm going to get a case of it. How much alcohol is in a non-alcoholic beer, or whatever the designation is? Less than 0.5% alcohol is in that bottle, and it lit my disease up going up like an infield fly, man. And I brought it home to Marie, and we opened our bottles of beer, and I drank, and she drank, and her face turned red, and I go, oh, boy. That's the kind of alcoholic I am. I cannot be around it. I don't eat Mother Murphy's rum balls. I don't do anything that has alcohol in it. But the question I would like to ask you is, where does it hurt? Where does it hurt? If somebody's going to ask you, where does it hurt? What might you say? I met a wonderful man 7 years ago who came up after I talked, and he said, man, it hurts in my soul. Bingo. When the spiritual maladies overcome, you know, we straighten out mentally and physically. I've never seen anybody outrun alcoholism. You know, I've never seen anybody outwork alcoholism. This is not an intellectual issue. It's a physical, spiritual issue. And it's deadly. Bart, you asked me to talk about the Fellowship of the Spirit, and I'm gonna do it. When you put the sign up here for 5 minutes, I want to spend a few minutes and just talk a little bit about the origins of Fellowship of the Spirit, because you asked, okay, but I tripped into Mickey here, and so. So I started out on this path, and Marie is like, Marie has never once threatened to leave me in 48 years, and I can't even count the times that I've threatened to leave her. You know what I mean? Because if I get cornered, I run to the end of my ability to cope very quickly. You know? And I go from here to H-bomb. And she stayed with me. And she's my best friend. Marie and I talk about the fact that we only have to say goodbye once. Now, we've been married 48 years with 6 weeks off for bad behavior. Now, I moved out and got myself some flea bag place to live, and I couldn't work the heater, and I'm laying there in an army raincoat freezing my butt off. But I'm free. I'm out of that house, man. We hit a place where we could no longer meld into each other. And, you know, we couldn't work it out. And at the last minute, we talked to each other and said, we'll give it another shot. I was with my kids, with our three children. We have a daughter and two sons. And I was with them while I was in that flea-bitten doodah that I was living in. Oh, but I have to tell you, you'll love this. This is for the Al-Anon ladies in the house, or men. I moved into that house, and Marie came over and set it up for me. She brought the silverware. Absolutely, you know what I mean? And the thought of having another woman in my life or in my house, it was just no go. It was just no go. So anyway, thank you, God, we got back together. During that time, while we were separated, I didn't know what to do with myself, so I went over and started working out for one time in my life. I put 2.5 inches on each arm. I was buff. You want to see the body that loneliness built? And I came back to Marie and moved back in with her, and I'm walking to the front of the house, and across the street neighbor yelled something, and I couldn't believe it. I thought he goes, yo, gonad. He said, Conan. I was pissed. I came back in with a resentment. Come on, man, what are you talking about? Anyway, the muscles are all gone and they're never coming back. So where does it hurt? I didn't really know where it hurt, and I started going down this road with Alcoholics Anonymous, and it went like this. I was sitting in a meeting and I wanted to kill myself again. And I thought, I know you spilled more on your tie than I drank, and I get it. We're very competitive. We're human. And you want to tell me how you're, you know, better, and I'm flunking AA like I flunked all the rest of it. And I thought, where do I go for help? I'm scared. I'm scared I'm going to do this. And I thought, I don't know how to get help, because if I started to talk, really, in those days, they called it psychobabble. If I talked about my feelings in a discussion meeting, they told you to shut up and whatever, right? A lot of help. And they were doing the best they had, I guess. So I got a book, and it was not, it was an outside book, and it was written by this monk, and I just started reading it, and I read 4 or 5 chapters in that book. Now, what I did is I went through the chain of command in this very tough group I was in to talk to the head high guy, and I probably talked about this yesterday, but anyway, and he was very imposing. He was a great big guy. And I tell him what was going on with me, and I thought, now he's going to hit me with the wand, and something's going to give here. And he looks at me and says, I don't know, man, maybe you're going to drink. This is my life. This is my life. So I went back and I started reading this book. And in the book, they talked about suffering. They talked about how difficult it is to be transformed. And they talked about all the darkness that people can encounter on this road of faith. And what this monk was describing was that a massive spiritual experience, and I was right in the middle of it. So you may think that's a little horse patootie. Who gives a damn about some Catholic monk? I don't care about the Catholic monk. I want the truth. I want the truth. So if that doesn't mean anything to you, what I said, let's go and look at the caterpillar. Here comes this ugly squish bug, you hardly can locomote, going down the sidewalk with about, I guess, a jillion feet. Maybe there's some insect demonimus around us, but anyway. And he's going down the thing, and he crawls up in a tree, and he starts to spin a chrysalis. Or she starts to spin a chrysalis. And that animal gets pulled completely out of every joint possible in the dark and emerges as one of God's most glorious creatures. Does that make any more sense about what this monk was writing about? And I held on to him, and I held on to that, and I thought, my God. And I talked to George, and I said, George, my sponsor, if God will allow, I will never stop talking about the second half of the first step as long as I live. Because if we're dry, and we've followed all the rules, and we've danced to the tune, and we've, you know, followed the yellow brick road, and we're desperate and lonely and broke and can't see our way out of anything, is it possible that we may want to take a look at the fact that the disease of alcoholism doesn't exist in a bottle of alcohol? Now think about the Mormon community. The Mormon people, I guess in bulk or a majority, they don't drink. But 1 out of 10 people, the common wisdom, in the world has the disease of alcoholism. Now here they are, they got alcoholism. They have no idea what the heck's wrong with them. And I use that booze to treat my disease and to try to stay, to get some kind of a life. So now I started paying attention to this. Now, this is not a poor me statement, but I couldn't talk to anybody in AA where I was about what I had discovered. I've got this great discovery, and they don't care, and they don't hear it. I guess they were having a different experience, or it was sufficient. You know, never mistake activity for productivity. We'll just go out there. I'm going to be in service. I am going to be in service. And I noticed in my junior time in AA that I would look at all the state chairmen and they were all divorced. They were all divorced. And you can ask some of the kids in our families, how do you feel about Alcoholics Anonymous? And they say, I hate it because it took my mom and dad away from me. But anyway, they couldn't sustain it, and I could hardly live. So Alcoholics Anonymous, to me, reached down into me and said, take a look at these things. And when we saw, it says, was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see news reels of lunar flight solution of these bedevilments? What? We're going to get a solution to the things I just read you? When we saw others solve that, and here comes the most important plural word I ever read in my life. When we saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas did not work, but the God idea did. Can somebody please help me? I am really suffering. I'm dying in here. And I had a loaded .32 automatic in the top drawer of our dresser, and it was there for 2 years, 3 years. And Marie didn't ever know if she went to work that day or went out whether she was going to come back and see me with dead. And that gun to me represented, if this doesn't work, because I'm not kidding, this isn't Miss Gloria's day school, you know. If this doesn't work, I'm putting my brains on the wall. And then one day I took the gun and put it away. Now, my love for Al-Anon, you just can't know how much I love Al-Anon. Think about it, an F-4 fighter, Phantom, you have the pilot, and they write books about the pilot, and the pilot's so heroic, and he is heroic. He's out there doing his job. But they have a wizzo, a weapons officer, riding behind him. And the weapons officer doesn't get a vote about where we're going. That was Marie. I did not give her a vote about that gun. I just said, this is the way it is. And God bent down and had mercy on us. I'm not the worst alcoholic who ever came in here, but how do you want to measure it? Do you want to measure it about I drank for 95 years under a truck in a garbage depot? Is that, now do we make you president of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I thought I was too young at 27 to be an alcoholic. And then I walked into York Street one day and there was a 14-year-old girl in there for her first meeting, and I had to take a total revision of how bad does it hurt. It just has to hurt bad enough for us to say, Uncle, I want out. Now, we are a community. How much time do I have? Okay. We have a community of people just in this room that can change the world, and we are changing the world. I'll give you a simple example of changing the world. I sponsor a guy in Brooklyn. And that guy took us talking seriously and reading the book seriously. I met him at a retreat at Mount Manresa in Staten Island. And so I said, you know, I have to make amends for all the things that we've done. And so he goes to a newsstand in Brooklyn and says, I stole a comic when I was a kid, and I want to pay back for it. And you know, New Yorkers can be very skeptical. And he probably thought my buddy was stupid. But my buddy wasn't stupid. And I sponsor another guy in Philadelphia. And when we started working together, he told me he was an armed robber. And I thought, okay. Because I know what the book says about how we're going to have to make amends here. And I loved him, and I didn't want to have to say it. But he'd been trying to get sober for 20 years. And he was doing it, and he was doing the do. So I told him one day, I said, man, you're going to have to go back and make restitution for the money that you stole. And I'll just tell you one story. So he had robbed a Tibetan store, you know, with all the bells and whistles. And he robbed that Tibetan store, and he went back in there, and he'd done it with a baseball bat. And the clerk in there, this young woman, was being threatened with serious damage to fork up the money. And he had calculated that he owed $300. And so he said, now the owner of the store is in there. So he goes up to him and he said, do you remember what a couple of years back, whatever it was, that your store was robbed? And the man said, yes. And he said, well, I'm the man who robbed you. And I came to pay back the money I stole from you. And he, you know, calculated it at $300 and said, I came to pay you. And the Tibetan owner of the store looked at him and he says, do you meditate? And my guy says, yes, I do. And he said, and he reached into the case and he put a tape or a disc on the counter and he said, this may help you meditate. I don't want your money. This helped restore my karma. The grace of a loving God. And that man today is one of my best friends. And friends to a lot of other people who love him. See, this 45 years is like, I'm not bragging on that. It's like I just didn't die. But there's so many stories that are coming in. It was a really good story too, but it's gone. It's gone. It's gone. So the people I got to work with, I told my mom. Now, my mom was desperately ashamed of the fact. I said, Mom, I've discovered I'm an alcoholic. Mickey, don't say that. My mother was from Memphis, Tennessee, honey. And she didn't want to hear about it. You know, her baby, Mickey, it cannot be flawed. We're not going to hear about this. And I just tried to, you know, tell her. And I said, well, you know, we went to help this guy the other night. She said, well, you always wanted to be a missionary. And then she always watched these soap operas. And in one of her soap operas, they had a character who copped to being alcoholic. Now my mom's all down for it, man. My son's the president of AA. Thank you for the soap operas. You never know when you're going to get a saving hand here. Going down this road is hard. It's very, very hard. Alcoholism is a deadly disease. When it makes a move, you're going to know it. So I went down the road, and we had some good times. We had some bad times. And I ran into a situation. No, it wasn't a situation. I just tiptoed off the reservation. And for, I'm guessing, and Lord, please help me to not lie. I did 10 years or maybe 15, 10 years without a sponsor. I mean, I, you know, commune with my brother wizards. I'm making a joke out of it now, but it's the truth. I, you know, what do you got? And I would tell what I have, and it's like, whatever. And where that ended, and I would have bet anything in the world that this would never, ever happen to me. Where that ended was me laying on the floor in an office that I did not pay rent on, under a telephone that never rang, with a business that was busted, and Marie's dealing with the creditors, and I collapsed. I fell out of my chair. I was sitting there by myself. I fell out of my chair onto the floor, and I pulled a knife out, and I thought, this is it. I'm getting out of here. And I spent 4 hours on the floor in hell. And if you define hell as the absence of God, That's where I was. It was the blackest, darkest place I ever encountered, and I hope nobody ever goes there. And I knew how to cut my wrist because we get that information. Right? And I thought, if I cut myself on this floor, and it was like AstroTurf carpet, it was really not great. If I cut myself on this floor, I'm going to make, oh my goodness, I'm going to make a big mess. So I got to crawl out the back door, and I couldn't, and blah, da, 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 da. I'll finish it real quickly. And so I couldn't kill myself, thank God. I called somebody. I had met a woman in Minneapolis, from Minneapolis, and she told me about a guy in St. Paul that she really thought the world of. And I wanted to get in touch with him so I could get somebody to help me. So I called her. And when I was going down and failing in my life, I only said two things to God. I said, God, I can't breathe. And would you please give me a cookie? I just wanted one thing that was sweet in this misery, darkness that I was in. So I called this woman. I told her the situation. 5 minutes. I know. I mean, I didn't even get to chapter 2. Anyway, I called her and I told her my situation, and she broke out her Alcoholics Anonymous literature in her lap, and she's 12-stepping me, and I'm listening to her, and it's everything I need to hear, and I asked her if she'd be my sponsor, and she said, oh no. You know, boys with boys, girls with girls, and I'm dying. And I didn't even get that guy's number. And I said, please, will you be my sponsor? And I knew she was a woman. She had less sobriety than me. I couldn't have cared less. I was like 23 years sober. And so she said, okay, I'll work with you until you find a male sponsor. And I said, okay. And she saved my life, and she stayed with me for 4 years. And her name was Cookie. Bidden or unbidden, God is here. Bidden or unbidden, God is here. That I found this profession that I have is a story that I would love to tell you, but I can't because I ran out of time. I put this talk in God's hands. I hope it went somewhere that was of use. I could not, with these hands, drive a nail with a hammer. And I do nothing but precision work all day long in making cowboy boots. And I make beautiful boots, not because I'm any damn good, but because God is good. And I never thought anybody would ever buy a pair of cowboy boots from me. And I was desperate. And Marie and I went into $158,000 worth of debt trying to build that business. And we paid it off. Don't turn your back on the beast. Don't kid yourself that you can't be laying on the floor with a knife at your wrist. Don't think that you're so got it made that you're like smooth as mayonnaise. Because you might end up grease. I have separation anxiety. I'm going to hang on to you as long as I possibly can right now. I don't want to let you go. I don't know how you felt about this talk. I don't know how you feel about any of my opinions or what happened to me. But I love you, and I can't let you go, so I'm just going to da-da-dee-dee-dee until she blows me off this stage. And I didn't honor it, Bart. I'm so sorry. Oh, my God, I can share it, she said. Okay. All right, Fellowship of the Spirit. So a bunch of us had been going around the country talking at various places on the circuit, and we'd go to towns, and they had a more intimate collection of a number of people, and we had like the state convention, and the state convention was 1,500 people with breakout rooms and video feeds and all this kind of stuff, and I just wanted us to have one that was more intimate, and so through a series of talking with Gary B. and Mike L. and people in Indianapolis, and talking with Don Pritz, Marie and I said, okay, we will go get a venue. We'll get a hotel. Let's do it in the mountains so we can show off our mountains and be proud of them. And we'll get the hotel, and you provide the man and woman power. And so that's how we started Fellowship of the Spirit. Now, we had to talk about a variety of things. And I can tell you, you talk about tears. Oh, my God. You get a collection of us in a room, and we're going to make a single decision with any little wrinkle, and it's mayhem. I thought they were going to shoot arrows in me in my own living room. It was... But we stuck to our guns because we'd gotten some advice from people about certain things, and we did that. And we got this thing put together, and it was called the Breckenridge Conference, because we went into Breckenridge, Colorado with it. And we had 225 people show up. Now, who was talking about it being the Cannes Film Festival? You were. So what happened is Joe Hawk went out, and he talked to a lot of people and said, come be with us, come be with us. Because Don Pritz was involved in this thing, and Joe Hawk was out beating the drum, we had 225 people show up, okay? 225 people from 25 states. From 25 states, they came to be in Colorado with us seeking God. Now, I wanted to have it where you have five speakers and then plenty of time for people to enjoy the mountains and be with their families or whatnot. And Don said, well, no, let's have step workshops. I fought against it. I'm smart that way. And so what we are doing, what we've been doing here, is thanks to Don Pritz. And what went from what I thought was, let's have a lot of air in this thing, went to what we have here. You can't turn around before your butt's back in a seat and you're growing spiritually. Thank you. And I totally subscribe to this. Now, what happens is we started having, like, people, the folks from Santa Fe would bring up, you know, Mexican food, the folks from Louisiana, they would bring up shrimp etouffee and, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And we had people, and we'd go room to room and we'd share meals with each other. And I noticed, I walked into one of the rooms and there was a girl from New York sitting next to a guy from Louisiana. And she said, now, where's that fourth column in the resentment inventory? And he's leaning over talking to her. And we got Louisiana and New York talking to each other. And I went out for a break just to look at the mountains. And there was a young man standing out on the little patio thing with me. And I looked over at him. I didn't know him. And the tears were just slowly running down his cheeks. And I said, are you okay? And he said, yeah. And I said, would you mind if I ask you why you're crying? And he said, there are four of us in Muscatine, Iowa, around our big book. And he said, I've never seen so many people work out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our text. What's that? Yeah. So, I'm with you, Rodney. Thank you. So, anyway, but the point is, I'm seeing people learning about a fullness of an approach to getting and staying well right in front of us, and I'm seeing people rely on the big book instead of my sponsor says. My sponsor says this, and I'm sure you have a great sponsor, but I need what's in this book. This is my bullshit sifter. That's what they told me. And if it's not in here, Mickey, you don't have to pay attention to. You don't have to do it. So this is the one. Imagine how many strong personalities are in this room tonight. You know, we'll tell you what it is, right? This is our referee. Can we not agree to come together here? And that's what we've been expressing in this weekend. So now there's Fellowship of the Spirit, Ukraine. There's Fellowship of the Spirit, Moscow. There's Fellowship of the Spirit, Johannesburg, South Africa. I talked, you know, on Skype to them. I've got goosebumps running all the way up from my legs. We've got it all around the world. Iceland.
Australia.
Texas. No, I'm just... Yeah, everywhere. Whoa, it's really big now. Incidentally, I have this factoid. I'm throwing it in since I got this for a minute. Brooklyn is so big, at one time they were thinking of making it a state. That's how big Brooklyn is. Isn't that amazing? Right, Devin? Where are you? There you go. Anyway, so it's around the world. It's around the world. And here's what happens. Fellowship of the Spirit is a family, okay? We have known Tom and Juanita for 25, 26 years. I've got in my pocket a key to their house. And we can go down there when they're not there. We let them know. And Tom says, can you get it back from him? No. Our son is a Catholic priest. Our baby, Peter, is a Catholic priest. And he married Nate and Lindsay. I mean, you know what I'm saying? And I've talked to Nikki on the phone and just think she's absolutely out of this world. And we met heart to heart on the phone calls that we've had. And that's what this is heart to heart. Okay, we all are individuals. Our fingerprints prove it. We're all individuals. But there's a difference. I'm trying to find out how to express it for years. There's a difference with Fellowship of the Spirit in this way. I can't summarize it, but here's as close as I can get. We're not mechanics. We are really working with your heart and my heart, our souls. Because when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. I didn't know I had a soul till I came in here and it started getting fed. If you talk to my head, we're done. Because there's a man who used to say he's rubber-minded. I can take any thought and twist it around and come out a loser. But if we talk heart to heart, we'll come together. You like that one, Scott? If we talk to each other heart to heart and stay in this book, we're going to stay alive and we're going to grow. One person can change the world. One person can change the world. Marie and I and the people that joined us, we've changed the world. And there's another wave coming, and that is to be even deeper into working in the heart. Thank you so much for inviting me, for having Marie and I come and be with you. You are a family. We love you, and God bless you. We get it done at all.